From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this President's Day edition of Fresh Air, presidential speeches from the 20th century. They're collected on a CD box set. We'll talk with the co-producers of the collection, Sam Berlowski and Cooper Graham of the Library of Congress. Also, why daily White House briefings are like psychological warfare. We hear from Marlon Fitzwater, former press secretary to Presidents Reagan and Bush Sr. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the indie rock band Low's latest CD, Things We Lost in the Fire. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush helped dedicate a new national museum in Oklahoma City today. The Memorial Center is meant to remember the 168 people who died as a result of the federal building bombing.
Memorials do not take away the pain. They cannot fill the emptiness. But they can make a place in time and tell the value of what was lost. The debris is gone and the building is no more. Now this is a place of peace and remembrance and life.
The $7 million museum contains pictures and reminders of the victims' lives before the blast in April of 1995. France has issued a strongly worded condemnation of the bombings carried out by the United States and Britain against Iraq last Friday. Reaction around the world has been largely negative. NPR's Sarah Chase reports.
Speaking in a television interview, the French foreign minister said, "We've believed for a long time that there's no basis for this type of bombing." 24 British and American warplanes carried out a series of strikes against what were identified as air defense command and control sites south of Baghdad. The French foreign minister said, as far as he's aware, the raid was approved by hardly anyone. He reiterated French opposition to sanctions against Iraq, saying they're taking the Iraqi people hostage with little apparent impact on the regime of Saddam Hussein. France did for a time help police the no-fly zones above northern and southern Iraq, but in recent years has distanced itself. The late President François Mitterrand is known to have sent a businessman to Baghdad as a special envoy despite the embargo. Sarah Chase, NPR News, Paris.
NASCAR racing fans are mourning the death of champion driver Dale Earnhardt. Experts at Ford Motor Company say the crash might not have been fatal if Earnhardt had been wearing a new head and neck support. Quinn Kleinfelter reports from member station WDET in Detroit.
When Earnhardt crashed into the wall at Daytona, he likely suffered a basal skull fracture, the kind of injury that has killed several NASCAR drivers in the past year. But Ford Motor Racing spokesperson Kevin Kennedy says Earnhardt might have survived had he not been reluctant to wear a new head and neck support, known by the acronym HANS.
The neck is going forward, and they're having the fracture at the base of the skull there. Now, the HANS device is designed to help reduce the amount that the head and the neck will go. So will that make a difference? It will make a difference in a lot of cases. Would it have made the difference in this case? I don't think anybody knows that.
Autopsy results on Earnhardt cannot determine whether a neck brace would have saved him, but Ford says it is recommending that all of its drivers in NASCAR now wear the HANS brace. For NPR News, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter in Detroit.
Gusty winds in Florida and California are keeping the space shuttle Atlantis from its planned return to Earth. NASA managers say the crosswinds make it too dangerous. This is NPR. A new study finds that the slowdown in the economy and the decline in the stock market are putting a damper on the growth of philanthropic foundations in the U.S. The researchers noted that during lean economic times, charities typically become more reliant on private foundations for funding. NPR's Craig Windham reports.
Even some of the nation's best-known foundations have been feeling the pinch of the economic downturn. The assets of the David and Lucille Packard Foundation in California fell 25% last year. The Packard Foundation invests almost entirely in Hewlett-Packard stock. The study by the Chronicle of Philanthropy, which focuses on nonprofit organizations, found that about half of the foundations are expecting no increase in the grants they will make this year, and about 10% said they will give away less than last year. Not all such groups are hurting, though. The nation's wealthiest philanthropy, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, boosted its giving last year to $1 billion on the strength of a $5 billion infusion of money from the Microsoft founder and his wife. Craig Windham, NPR News, Washington.
Federal safety officials say a Navy submarine commander is refusing to talk to investigators about the sinking of a Japanese fishing vessel. A spokesman for the National Transportation Safety Board says Commander Scott Waddle met with investigators over the weekend but refused to comment on the collision. Waddle reportedly held back on the advice of his lawyer pending the Navy's investigation. The NTSB spokesman said Waddle did agree to answer some questions in writing, but only on the search and rescue after the collision. The submarine was practicing an emergency surfacing maneuver when it came up under the Japanese vessel. 9 people from the Japanese ship are still missing. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo Marriott Services, providing customized approaches to food and facilities management services in healthcare, education, and corporations. SodexoMarriott.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This President's Day, we're going to listen back to presidential speeches from the 20th century and consider some of the changes in what presidents say and how they say it. My guests, Sam Berlowski and Cooper Graham, compiled a CD box set that collects historic presidential speeches from 1908 to 1993. Berlowski and Graham work in the Library of Congress's Division of Motion Picture Broadcasting and Recorded Sound. Their CD of presidential speeches is a co-production of the Library of Congress and Rhino Records. I spoke with them when the CD was released in 1995. In a moment, we'll hear an excerpt of President Roosevelt's first fireside chat, broadcast just weeks after he took office in 1933 during the Great Depression. I asked Berlowski about the significance of this speech.
What he did was he went directly to the people. He didn't give a speech to Congress. He didn't go to a major organization. He went directly to the people. And this was a very significant thing that Roosevelt did by going to the people so often through radio. It sort of usurped machine politics at the time. One traces the descendancy of machine politics to Franklin Roosevelt and the fact that he skips over them and goes directly to the people over the radio through what were called intimate chats.
So before we hear this 1933 fireside chat, Roosevelt's first fireside chat, tell us what the crisis is that he's addressing so we can hear this in context.
There was a depression, and the depression had gotten worse and worse to the point where a lot of banks were having all their money pulled by anxious depositors who felt that all the banks were going to fail. Of course, any bank has far more deposits in it than it has cash on hand, so the banks would have... there would have been a run on all the banks in the United States, and there would have been complete financial panic. Roosevelt has a reputation of being a liberal, but at that point, I think the business community was sufficiently frightened that they were also asking that he take any steps that were necessary to try to avert this crisis. I don't think most people now can imagine how serious it was. So there was an awful lot riding on this speech to try to persuade Americans not to pull their money out of the banks.
So let's hear it. This is Franklin Roosevelt, his first fireside chat, 1933.
First of all, let me state the simple fact that when you deposit money in a bank, the bank does not put the money into a safe deposit vault. It invests your money in many different forms of credit, in bonds, in commercial paper, in mortgages, and in many other kinds of loans. In other words, the bank puts your money to work to keep the wheels of industry and of agriculture turning round. A comparatively small part of the money that you put into the bank is kept in currency, an amount which in normal times is wholly sufficient to cover the cash needs of the average citizen. In other words, the total amount of all the currency in the country is only a comparatively small proportion of the total deposits in all the banks of the country. What then happened during the last few days of February and the first few days of March? Because of undermined confidence on the part of the public, there was a general rush by a large portion of our population to turn bank deposits into currency or gold. A rush so great that the soundest banks couldn't get enough currency to meet the demand. The reason for this was that on the spur of the moment, it was, of course, impossible to sell perfectly sound assets of a bank and convert them into cash except at panic prices far below their real value.
Franklin Roosevelt recorded in 1933 his first fireside chat. What was the public reaction to that first chat?
It was very, very favorable. Of course, the expected panic didn't take place, which is negative evidence, but seemed to be proof that a lot of people listened to the speech and took the president's words to heart. Also, there was an incredible amount of mail. The White House received something like four or five times the mail that it received after a speech by the previous administrations, to the point where they had to hire extra people to deal with it. So the response to Roosevelt's speech was overwhelming. One commentator says that within the space of this speech, capitalism was saved. Maybe it was.
On this new CD box set, you've included a speech by President Truman, recorded in 1948 upon accepting the Democratic nomination for president. Why did you choose this speech from Truman?
Going into this campaign, Truman was very much the underdog. Most people didn't think he had much of a chance. And his speaking style was generally considered to be terrible. It was a very flat, pronounced Missouri accent, and people had been talking to him for years about changing his style, trying to make his sentence shorter and punchier. And if he really could speak to an audience the way he could speak to friends of his at a poker game, he would be a wonderful speaker. And for some reason, at 2 o'clock in the morning of his acceptance speech of the Democratic candidate in 48, he seemed to take their advice to heart, because you hear Truman at his best in this speech.
Let's hear an excerpt of this speech, Harry Truman, from 1948, at the Democratic National Convention. He's accepting the nomination for president.
Confidence and security have been brought to the American people by the Democratic Party. Farm income has increased from less than $2.5 billion in 1933 to more than $18 billion in 1947. Never in the world were the farmers of any republic or any kingdom or any other country as prosperous as the farmers of the United States. And if they don't do their duty by the Democratic Party, they're the most ungrateful people in the world. Wages and salaries in this country have increased from $29 billion in 1933 to more than $128 billion in 1947. That's labor. And labor never had but one friend in politics, and that was the Democratic Party and Franklin D. Roosevelt. And I'll say to labor just what I've said to the farmers. They are the most ungrateful people in the world if they pass the Democratic Party by this year.
Harry Truman accepting the Democratic presidential nomination in 1948. I don't know if you'll agree with me on this, but it seems to me a presidential candidate would never call voters ungrateful. I mean, you don't say anything that could alienate any voters. What do you think?
I certainly agree with you. On the other hand, as Cooper said, this was 2 a.m. in the morning, so I'm not sure how many voters heard this address.
But there was also a drifting away, both by labor and by some of the farmers in 48, and I think it would not be considered to be necessarily a judicious thing to do, but it may have reminded them exactly who their friends were, and I think I would have been somewhat impressed by it if I'd been a union man or a farmer in 48.
Let's jump ahead to 1969. You've included an address by President Nixon to the nation on the war in Vietnam. Why did you include this speech?
Well, this is the silent majority speech. In making the selections for this set, which were mostly done by Cooper, he here, we decided, or Cooper had the great idea, that for current recent presidents and the current presidents, and we started this thing during the Bush administration, that we would contact the presidents or their staffs or families to see what speech they would like to be represented by. Initially, this was a contact to say, gee, we're going to preserve a speech in a special new process with some experiments we were doing at the Library of Congress. What speech would you like to be assured was preserved for posterity? And all of the presidents or their families from Mrs. Onassis on responded, but the Nixon office did not respond to Cooper.
Therefore, we decided to go with a speech that President Nixon admired. He had mentioned very favorably in the arena, that's the book, one of the books, he had mentioned his silent majority speech several times as being one of his best, and also he felt one that changed public opinion in the United States, so we decided to go along with it. And of course, silent majority is one of the best-known sort of catchwords of the period. Also, since it deals with Vietnam, we thought it was a topical, not a topical speech, but a speech that dealt with that that epic in American history. So for these reasons, we decided to go with a silent majority speech. It was evidently partly the speech that some commentators have said marked out a new group in the United States, some Democrat, some Republican, that might vote for Republicans in the future. And this, in fact, seems to have been a pretty accurate prediction.
Okay, Richard Nixon, recorded in 1969.
I have chosen a plan for peace. I believe it will succeed. If it does not succeed, what the critics say now won't matter. Or if it does succeed, what the critics say now won't matter. If it does not succeed, anything I say then won't matter. I know it may not be fashionable to speak of patriotism or national destiny these days, but I feel it is appropriate to do so on this occasion. 200 years ago, this nation was weak and poor. But even then, America was the hope of millions in the world. Today, we have become the strongest and richest nation in the world. And the wheel of destiny has turned, so that any hope the world has for the survival of peace and freedom will be determined by whether the American people have the moral stamina and the courage to meet the challenge of free world leadership. Let historians not record that when America was the most powerful nation in the world, we passed on the other side of the road and allowed the last hopes for peace and freedom of millions of people to be suffocated by the forces of totalitarianism. And so tonight, to you, the great silent majority of my fellow Americans, I ask for your support. I pledged in my campaign for the presidency to end the war in a way that we could win the peace. I have initiated a plan of action which will enable me to keep that pledge. The more support I can have from the American people, the sooner that pledge can be redeemed. For the more divided we are at home, the less likely the enemy is to negotiate at Paris. Let us be united for peace. Let us also be united against defeat. Because let us understand, North Vietnam cannot defeat or humiliate the United States. Only Americans can do that.
President Nixon's silent majority address, recorded in 1969, on the war in Vietnam. You know, it's interesting. I mean, he didn't reprise the words silent majority a lot during that address. What do you think it was about those words that caught on?
I think that sort of that, I don't know, I guess the polarizing aspect of the speech is what made it catch on, by dividing the public into camps. It's important to remember that the context of this speech is all these mass demonstrations going on outside the White House at the time. So by calling someone silent, you're placing them in comparison to these dirty hippies who were, you know, burning flags and having these sort of, in many cases, you know, unseemly protests going on in the shadow of the Lincoln Memorial.
My guests are Sam Brolowski and Cooper Graham of the Library of Congress. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Sam Brolowski and Cooper Graham of the Library of Congress. In 1995, they produced a box set of presidential speeches of the 20th century. That set is still in print. Now, let's jump ahead to President Clinton. You've chosen a speech from 1993, his remarks to the convocation of the Church of God in Christ. What is this speech about, and what do you think it shows about Clinton's style of speechmaking?
Well, this speech is about race in the United States and class and economic policy in the United States. I think it was a very successful speech for him, at least in its immediate response. It was to an African-American audience in Memphis. I think that, as Cooper said earlier about President Truman, Clinton has a very good reputation for one-on-one speaking. He's a very charismatic speaker privately. And I don't think that his reputation is as good as a public speaker, but I think he tries to be somewhat intimate, if that's a word you can be, with the hundreds or thousands listening to this speech.
Okay, this is President Clinton, an excerpt of a speech to the convocation of the Church of God in Christ, 1993.
If Martin Luther King, who said, like Moses, I am on the mountaintop and I can see the promised land, but I'm not going to be able to get there with you, but we will get there. If he were to reappear by my side today and give us a report card on the last 25 years, what would he say? Say, you did a good job, he would say, voting and electing people who formerly were not electable because of the color of their skin. You have more political power, and that is good. You did a good job, he would say, letting people who have the ability to do so live wherever they want to live, go wherever they want to go in this great country. You did a good job, he would say, elevating people of color into the ranks of the United States Armed Forces to the very top, or into the very top of our government. You did a very good job, he would say. He would say, you did a good job creating a black middle class of people who really are doing well, and the middle class is growing more among African Americans than among non-African Americans. You did a good job. You did a good job in opening opportunity. But he would say, I did not live and die to see the American family destroyed. I did not live and die to see 13-year-old boys get automatic weapons and gun down 9-year-olds just for the kick of it. I did not live and die to see young people destroy their own lives with drugs and then build fortunes destroying the lives of others. That is not what I came here to do. I fought for freedom, he would say, but not for the freedom of people kill each other with reckless abandon, not for the freedom of children to have children and the fathers of the children walk away from them and abandon them as if they don't amount to anything. I fought for people to have the right to work, but not to have whole communities and people abandoned. This is not what I lived and died for. My fellow Americans, he would say, I fought to stop white people from being so filled with hate that they would wreak violence on black people. I did not fight for the right of black people to murder other black people with reckless abandon.
What do you find effective about the excerpt that we just heard?
I think the setting itself is significant. It's in the South. I couldn't prove this now, but I think his Southern accent is a little more pronounced than it is on a normal news conference, a televised news conference. And also, of course, he is in a church, and I think he, you know, President Clinton spent a lot of time going to church in the South, and I think there's a rhetorical style reflected, a sermon style reflected in this speech. I think he's very comfortable giving this speech. It's a accepting audience. This was not going to be a major address. I'm sure there were cameras there, but this was not for live television. This was for a group that he felt very comfortable with. I sort of erroneously called it intimate. It's not so much that it's a one-on-one style of speaking. It's obviously a very rhetorically flamboyant speech, but he's very comfortable, and I think he feels that the audience is very accepting of him while giving the speech.
You're both at the Library of Congress and work with sound recordings. Now, in the early 1900s, there weren't many sound recordings, so if you have something from a president, it's a wonderful, special, rare thing to have. What with local television and radio, national television and radio, and then C-SPAN, you know, playing this kind of stuff all the time, there's zillions and zillions now of presidential comments. What's it like for you? Are you getting inundated with presidential speeches and other political speeches that you have to catalog?
Yes, we are. We are getting inundated. It's partially we welcome it. We would not want to have less. Of course, we would like to have more time and more people and more money to do it better, but I would certainly not want to see the flood stop. I think we're very privileged to live in an age where we can have this. And it's also very difficult to say what might not be important 20 years from now. So I think we have to take it all and catalog it and store it and preserve it best we can.
Sam Berlowski and Cooper Graham work with the Library of Congress's Division of Motion Picture Broadcasting and Recorded Sound. They co-produced a CD of presidential speeches from the 20th century. Our interview was recorded in 1995 when the CD was first released. It's still in print. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Incorporated's Vintage Books, publishers of the new paperback A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius by Dave Eggers, updated with new material. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, Marlon Fitzwater, press secretary for Presidents Reagan and Bush Sr., talks about doing damage control after presidential gaffes and mishaps, like throwing up in the lap of the Japanese prime minister. And Ken Tucker reviews the latest CD by indie rock band Low. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this President's Day, we're going to hear about life as a presidential press secretary. While serving as press secretary to Presidents Reagan and Bush Sr., Marlon Fitzwater developed three rules: cave early and often, grovel if you have to, and you can run and hide. He wrote a memoir about his experiences in the White House called Call the Briefing. He was in tight spots during momentous events like the Iran-Contra hearings and the Gulf War, and for less historic occasions like when President Bush threw up in the lap of the Japanese prime minister. Fitzwater was Vice President Bush's spokesman in 1985, became President Reagan's press secretary in 87, replacing Larry Speaks, and served during the Bush presidency. In 1995, Fitzwater told me he thought of his daily White House press briefings as psychological warfare.
I used to plan for the press briefing for 2 or 3 hours every day. And a big part of that planning was to sit down with my staff and say, okay, what's the mood of the press corps? Give me a feedback. I want you to circulate among them, find out, you know, who had a bad night, who's getting a divorce, who's angry with the president, who thinks we're nuts to be doing this. And so that by the time I go out there at 11 o'clock, I want to know what these people are thinking, what their attitudes are, and where they're coming from. And as it turns out, the press is back in the back of the room doing the same thing about me. They're asking each other, you know, is Marlon in a good mood today? Is this going to be a contentious kind of briefing, or is it going to be fun? Do we have a lot of issues to deal with, or only one? And so there's a very psychological battle that goes on, and both sides get ready for it.
Now, you didn't allow your press briefings to be recorded for broadcast. Why not?
Well, mainly because if I said something stupid, I didn't want to repeat it every 15 minutes on camera. And that's the honest reason. The more institutional reason is that I felt it gave me the freedom to answer questions a little more fully if I didn't have to worry about how it appeared on television. Because on TV, you have to maintain a certain presence and dignity. Whereas there were times where I wanted to argue with the press corps. I wanted to convince them we were right, and that didn't always call for a good television picture.
Now, as press secretary, you sometimes have to cover up for presidential gaffes. In fact, in your memoir, you reprint a funny cartoon that has President Reagan saying, 2 + 2 = 5, and then it has you saying what the president really meant was.
Yes, the press is always eager to get you to amplify on the president's words or at least to acknowledge that he didn't quite know what he was saying. And after President Reagan's speeches, the press would always say, did the president really mean to say that this is the way the country was going? And finally, I just got around to saying the president said what he meant and meant what he said and try to let it go at that. But there's always a kind of a second-day examination of everything the president said.
What is one of the gaffes you did have to cover up for?
Well, I don't know. I suppose maybe the most famous one with President Reagan, which actually Larry Speaks was the press secretary then, and I was his deputy. But when President Reagan did a radio broadcast from Santa Barbara and joked before the broadcast about, look out, Russia, the bombs are coming in 5 minutes. And the whole government was having to cover up for that one. We had to call the Allies and tell them there wasn't any bombing happening. We had to call Russia and say, we're just kidding, folks. And we had to tell the press corps where the president was just joking. And it took us several days to get through that one.
After President Bush raised taxes in spite of his read my lips, no new taxes, you had to answer to that, too. How did you deal with that?
Well, it was a very disastrous decision for the president politically because it was interpreted by the American people as the president broke his pledge that he had made at the time of the convention. So it was a difficult issue to describe. Plus, our people in the White House never really faced up to kind of what the impact of that decision in terms of the president's pledge. And I think had we gone out right afterwards and said, look, this is a matter of conscience, and President Bush is trying to really do what Ronald Reagan said still needed to be done. We cut taxes, we made a strong defense, but we got a huge deficit that's got to be reduced. But instead, we never really got around to saying that very strongly. And that was a poor job, I think, on my part and everybody's part.
Now, after President Bush raised taxes, didn't you have to participate in calling those taxes revenue enhancers?
Well, the fellows...
To get around saying that, yes, these are really taxes.
Yeah, well, It was. We didn't have to do that very long because the press took one look at their revenue enhancement language and within 2 nanoseconds understood it was a tax increase and we'd broken the pledge.
Was this your idea to use this euphemistic phrasing?
No, this was the phrasing that was worked out by the budget negotiators themselves, including the president and a senior team on our side. And then the Democratic side was George Mitchell and Foley and Gebhardt and others. And they worked out this language. And the minute I saw it, I said to our chief of staff, you know, this is not going to fly. But they said, look, we negotiated this, go do it. And sure enough, it didn't fly 2 feet.
What's it like for you when you have to say something that you don't really believe in?
Well, you have to do it intellectually. I mean, there were 2 or 3 major issues that were central to the policies of President Reagan and President Bush that I did disagree with personally. And I took some pride in the idea that after 10 years, there really was nobody in the press corps who could identify those issues because I had to argue them all intellectually. When you have no heart in it, you have no emotion in it, but yet you have to make the case for the president the best way you can if you're a professional spokesman.
Would you care to say what those issues were that you disagreed on?
I'd rather not, but they were major social issues of some prominence and litmus test issues, really, for President Reagan and President Bush.
Now, you sometimes had to do damage control on yourself. You sometimes said the wrong thing at a briefing, and one example is when you called Gorbachev a drugstore cowboy.
Yeah, I think that was the worst, really, of my tenure.
What did you mean by that? I mean, I think of I saw the movie Drugstore Cowboy, and in that, it's people who rob drugstores to steal prescription drugs so that they could get high on them. What did you mean by Drugstore Cowboy?
You saw a pretty updated version from what I was talking about, I'll tell you. No, but we were looking for a way to describe the Soviet Union in 1989, because Gorbachev kept making speeches that was promising arms control reductions of various kind. He said, I'll reduce my conventional forces in the Eastern Bloc countries. I'll reduce nuclear warheads by 1/3. And he was promising all these things, but he never submitted a concrete plan to our negotiators to get to work on. And we were trying to find a way to kind of smoke him out. And so I looked it up in the dictionary, and it said a drugstore cowboy is one who makes promises he doesn't keep. And I said, that's perfect. That's exactly what I want to say. And I read it to my staff, and I said, how about this? I'm going to say they throw out these arms control proposals like a drugstore cowboy. And my staff said, don't do it, Marlon. That's terrible. That's the dumbest thing we ever heard. But I was convinced it's right, and the opportunity presented itself, and I did it. And the minute I did it, I knew I was in trouble. I mean, the press laughed and groaned, you know, like they do when you tell a bad joke, because they knew they had me. And I had miscalculated, frankly, how personal that term is. And the press shortened it immediately to Fitzwater calls Gorbachev a drugstore cowboy, when in fact I had said that he throws out arms control proposals like a drugstore cowboy. And I should have known that, I of all people.
Yeah, I wonder how that was translated into Russian. I mean, it's an idiom, you know.
I suspect they were afraid to translate it into Russian. I don't know. It'd be interesting to know how long it took him to take that to Mr. Gorbachev and say, sir, look what this guy Fitzwater is saying about you.
What would you say were the main differences between working as press secretary for President Reagan and President Bush?
Well, mainly their personal characteristics and how they chose to govern. The similarities were that they're both men of great dignity and honor and integrity and wonderful to work for. They were not shouters or screamers. They treated everybody with kindness. And in that sense, they were just terrific. The difference was that President Reagan liked his briefings in writing. If he had a decision to make, he'd want you to write it up, write down the options, give him the best arguments. He'd go home, he'd think about it, he'd come in the next morning with a check mark and say, that's it. And the result was that I could read the same briefing papers he read, and I knew what he knew, and I knew what his decisions were based on and what went into them. So I could be with President Reagan maybe 20% of the time during a day and know 80 or 90% of what he was doing and thinking. With President Bush, he liked oral presentations. He would bring people into his office, and they would discuss an issue, and he'd decide on the spot, okay, let's do this, let's do that, here's what I want to do. And so that I had to spend maybe 80% of my day with President Bush just to know what he was doing and thinking. So from a press secretary standpoint, it was a lot more time-consuming and difficult to keep track of President Bush's activities.
What was it like to prepare President Reagan for his press briefings? What For his press conferences, how would you prepare him?
Well, President Reagan had 48 press conferences in 8 years, as opposed to President Bush, who had 280 press conferences in 4 years. But they were different kinds of press conferences. And President Reagan liked the kind that utilized the abilities that he had as an actor and that he had learned in years before in terms of staging and presence and so forth. He liked the big formal press conferences in the East Room. And he didn't like to do them more than about once every couple months or so. So usually by the time he did a press conference, there were a lot of issues to catch up on. And we would have formal rehearsals the night before a press conference where we would fire questions at President Reagan so that he would hear them in advance and could practice his answers. And he concentrated on his answers almost like an actor does with a script, almost like they were memorized. And you could see it as soon as he felt he got it right, he kind of pushed an inner button someplace, and that memory was locked away. And sure enough, the next night at the press conference, it would come back in the same form.
During the Reagan presidency, many of his critics felt that that the president wasn't always grasping the details of the policies that his administration put forward, that he wasn't among the most intellectual presidents or even intelligent presidents, and he often got by on acting skills. When you'd hear those criticisms, how would you take it?
Well, I wince when I hear those things because I think they're so demeaning to a leader who understood the American character better than any president in the last 50 years, who gave America direction and strength. Probably now we recognize that even more than we did 10 years ago, and who understood policies quite well. He knew exactly what he wanted to do, and he knew how he wanted to do them. But he didn't bother a lot with the details, that's true.
My guest is Marlon Fitzwater. He served as press secretary to Presidents Reagan and Bush Sr. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1995 interview with Marlon Fitzwater about his life as press secretary to Presidents Reagan and Bush Sr. I think any nightmare for a presidential press secretary is when the president is sick. And you write about this a little bit in your memoir.
Right, uh-huh.
I remember when President Reagan had colon cancer.
Right, uh-huh.
Every network had a doctor with a pointer pointing to a representation of the presidential bowel.
Right.
And I was thinking, what was that experience like for you? What was that experience like for the president? I mean, it's a potentially very embarrassing thing.
Yeah. Well, it was really incredible. And when that happened, of course, President Reagan was in his 70s. Age had always been a concern to him. And then when it first was occurred, this was in his first term, and he still had to run for re-election. So you had two things working here that have a great impact on a presidential illness. One is that he's up for re-election and you're always worried that people think you're too sick to hold office. And the other is that this was during the Cold War. And people always had this fear that a president, if he ever lost consciousness or was out of sight for more than 2 minutes, somebody would send a nuclear bomb in here and he wasn't around to respond. So it was a very tense kind of situation. And we convinced the president, the staff around him, that he had to be totally open and honest with this illness. It was just coming out then that Jack Kennedy had covered up his drug use as a means of dealing with his back pain, and there'd been stories about Eisenhower had a heart attack for almost a year before anybody knew about it. And we convinced President Reagan that we've got to tell everything about this so that there's no question in the public minds that you're fit as a fiddle and ready to run again in age 76 or whatever it was, 74. And he agreed. But then when we saw the people on television holding up plastic models of his colon and tracing the various instruments that were being poked into his body, we said, whoa, maybe we've gone too far here. And so that was a frightening sight.
No, I must ask you about the day that President Bush threw up at the dinner of Japanese Prime Minister Keiichi Mizugawa.
Yes.
And that was actually on film. That must have been a miserable moment for you. What was your job after the illness?
Well, of course, the press secretary's job in any time like that is to give the American people and indeed the world some assurance about the status of their president. Is he sick? Is he okay? Is he going to survive? Has he been shot? If he's about to die, have you put in place all the constitutional systems to get the vice president sworn in? All those questions come into play. And so it's a very fearful time for a press secretary because every word is picked up and everything you say is blown out of proportion, or can be. And so in this case, President Bush got sick in the dinner with the prime minister. I was not at the dinner, but I immediately got a call, and put out the word to the press corps who were all around Tokyo, and they all gathered. But fortunately, President Bush was okay and went back to his hotel. But my job was to get on the air, on television and radio, as soon as possible to assure the world he was okay. In this case, it took me 45 minutes because I wanted to make darn sure from that doctor that what we were giving was accurate. And the worst thing is if you go out and say, well, the president just has the flu, and it turns out later that he was deathly ill. So you've really got to verify your facts quickly.
So you weren't sure. You thought he might be pretty sick at first.
Well, he looked sick to me. And I was sitting in the hotel, and I looked up at this TV screen as CNN played the tape of the president throwing up in the prime minister's lap, then falling down on the floor and being treated by the doctor. And I called up the president's physician. I said, have you seen that tape? It doesn't look like the flu to me. It looks like he's dead. What in the world is going on? I said, you better not be lying to me, doctor. I want to know every subject. And we went through it. And he says, Marlon, honest to God, it's just the flu. And he said, if you tried to do it through a state dinner when you had the flu, you're likely to pass out too. I said, yeah, right. And he said, you got to believe it, Marlon. I promise you this is all the case. And I said, all right, give me all the vital signs.
So what did you do to try to limit the damage?
Well, the first and most important thing to do was simply to show that it was a temporary illness and had no long-term impact. From a political standpoint, you had to identify the issues that this image impacted on. And the biggest impact in this case was that illness tended in people's minds to raise a question of, was he really fit? Could he run for president again? Was he get too old? That sort of thing. So you tend to then show pictures of the president jogging and working out and in physical situations. In President Bush's case, he was a very physical man, and that was not abnormal or hard to do.
Just one more question about this. How embarrassed was President Bush about the incident and about it being captured on film?
Well, it's interesting. He never really said anything about it. I mean, I think he was embarrassed. Certainly, he was very apologetic to the prime minister. But he was sick before he went to the dinner. And the doctor said, you really shouldn't go to this dinner. And he said, I've got to go. He said, they put all this on for me. The prime minister's gone to all this trouble. What do they do? He said, last minute I call in sick, they cancel the dinner. And he just didn't want to put them out. He said, I can make it through. And so I think he was more embarrassed about even trying to go to the dinner than he was about the idea that he actually got sick.
Is there a moment of your period as press secretary for Presidents Reagan and Bush that you would most like to do over again and get it right? Something you blew. something you blew that you wish you could do over.
Well, I'd like to do two events over. I'd like to do the drugstore cowboy over that we talked about.
Uh-huh.
And there was an event during the campaign when I was totally frustrated and tired. We'd been 10 points behind for 4 months. We weren't getting any closer, and everything was going wrong. And I couldn't get the press to come outside and see this great rally with 20,000 Oklahoma people shouting about how great President Bush was. And the press was just kind of sitting back in the auditorium listening to it on the speaker. And I went in and said, you lazy bastards, get out here and cover that event. And I've regretted that ever since.
How was that comment received by the press?
It was not received with great equanimity, no. They thought they were not very happy about it. And worst of all, I ruined the whole day for the president because all the stories were about Fitzwater's explosion. Fitzwater reflects the frustration of the campaign. Everything's going wrong. And I felt so sorry for President Bush. We had to go to three cities that day, and he had to go through all these speeches and all these handshakes and motions, knowing he would get no press out of it because it was all going to focus on my mistake. And that was really a horrible feeling for a press secretary to have.
Now, did you say anything about that at the briefing the next day?
Well, I didn't wait that long. Within an hour after I said it, I apologized to the press corps. I told the president what I had done, apologized to him, and I just let everybody know that they were right in the sense of it did represent the frustration of myself and probably the campaign as well, and that hopefully it wouldn't happen again.
Marlon Fitzwater served as press secretary to Presidents Reagan and Bush Sr. Our interview was recorded in 1995 after the publication of his memoir, Call the Briefing. He has a novel coming out this spring called Esther's Pillow. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews a new CD by the indie band Low. This is Fresh Air. The rock band called Low, formed in the mid-90s in Duluth, Minnesota, led by the husband and wife team of Alan Sparhawk and Mimi Parker. They've recorded for a number of small independent labels, and rock critic Ken Tucker says their newest release, Things We Lost in the Fire on the Cranky label, is one of their most compelling.
Sometimes it seems as if in the world of indie rock, everything's got to have a label, a genre to quantify a band's cult. In the case of Low's music, the group has been tagged with the term slowcore, that is, an opposite of hardcore, featuring low volume and slower melodies. The slowcore tag works only so far with Low. Like all good bands, their best music defies easy category. A ballad such as Laser Beam, for example, sung by drummer Mimi Parker, has a stark simplicity that almost recalls an old Appalachian folk ballad.
I don't need a laser beam. I don't need the time. Leave me your drunken mind. I need your grace.
I like the songs that are sung by Parker's husband, guitarist Alan Sparhawk, but I find Mimi Parker's vocals the most piercing. On the song Embrace, she voices the utter isolation of a lonely woman who hugs herself to feel human warmth and contact.
Holding my head for the last of the race. Push
Advancing from slowcore to majestic music, Sparhawk and Parker, along with bassist Zach Sally, build a number of songs on Things We Lost in the Fire around carefully harmonized vocals and pellucid guitar hooks that rarely lapse into merely languid melodies. Lowe occasionally grasps for a bigger, broader sound, letting the volume increase as the song's emotion warrants. The prime example of this is Dinosaur Act. Things We Lost in the Fire is the work of a band in such complete control of the mood it wants to create that its very rigorousness grants the music a kind of freedom. You get the feeling that, as lulling and lovely as much of this material is, it could fly off in any direction at any time. For all their murmured entreaties, Lowe knows what it wants and leads you through its collective subconscious like a wickedly intelligent tour guide.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Things We Lost in the Fire by Lowe. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Monique Nazareth, with Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, and Patty Leswing. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. I'm Terry Gross.
Black like a forest.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Random House Incorporated's Delta Trade Paperback Division, publisher of Confessions of a Shopaholic, a novel by British author Sophie Kinsella. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
February 24th marks the 10th anniversary of the ground phase of the Gulf War. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with two tank lieutenants about their experiences in the war. Join us for the next Fresh Air.